session number 9927, reel 3.
Reel 3. Did you find that was distressing, you know, hearing people cry and not being able to help them?
I think that would be distressing to anyone, especially if they were people whom we knew and liked and were comrades of ours. It's just part of the problems of fighting and war.
Did you have any idea, you know, when people were recovered from no man's land and were still living, what sort of medical care was available in, you know, on Suvla, in your area?
Well, all you could do was to use the equipment that you carry and tie the man up as best you can, try to stop him bleeding and so on. What's happening?
But, you know, did you have REMC personnel?
Yes, you called for them and they'd come along the trench and take over and get him back eventually. But there were a tremendous number of losses because of the great heat again amongst the wounded lying there to be picked up and so on. Frankly, I don't know a lot about what was happening there. We patched our people up and sent them back, sometimes even congratulating them on getting a blighty.
You mentioned earlier, you know, how you saw your first dead body as you were landing.
Yes.
And going up. You know, were there a lot of dead bodies about? You know,
after that, when we got onto the actual hillside and the trenches, there were bodies lying around. Mainly, I regret British, because there weren't. There must have been Turks. I don't really look for them. You know, I must admit that in a war like this, you don't see the enemy, because he's always hidden in his trenches. The only one you see is when you capture one. Now and then I've seen the prisoners being brought in that are being captured. Now, where are
the
we?
The Turkish prisoners, you mean? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, how did they impress you when you saw them?
They looked like ragged, blackened face, like hairy-looking peasants. Not soldierly-looking at all, but looking very tough, and obviously of you know, the peasant type.
What did you think of the mass fighters, the Turks?
The what?
Did you respect them as fighters?
Oh,
soldiers?
I think we respected them because we didn't see much of them, but we knew the moment we stuck our heads up, we'd get it shot at. We knew that they were alert and on the spot. I can, at this stage, tell you of one experience in which they put me in charge of the big dump of food. And we decided that we could only get this dump where it could be seen by the enemy, but would be a good spot under a hedge. So we dug two large 10-foot wide holes and covered them over with blankets so they were hidden from their sight. And in the day, we slept, myself and my guard of three or four men. And as soon as it was dark, you could hear the jingle of the muleteers, Indian muleteers, bringing the food on their mule wagons or carts. They would deliver this stuff in a great heap there outside and depart. And then, before daylight, the regiment would send down 20 men to carry it up to the actual line. Everything depended on complete secrecy and disguise, nothing to happen in the daytime. In the day, we crept under these blankets and were sleeping or resting and waiting for the food to come up. This went quite successfully, perhaps 3 or 4 weeks. And then one night, they didn't collect. So we thought, well, too bad for you, you'll have to have a double lot next time. So we went to sleep. When daylight came, we lifted the edge of our blanket and looked out, and to our horror, there stood 30 men standing and sitting and waiting to take their rations away. Of course, we shouted at once, "Make for cover," but too late, shell fire started, and they pounded us with shells, and a number were wounded and carried away, and even I got a small wound in the leg, but not bad enough to matter. It was all over in a couple of weeks. It soon healed up. I never went to the doctor. And, of course, we had to cancel the whole thing from then onwards. The Turks had found out just what you might call an error. Somebody at that unit, some NCO, had not ordered the troops out in the night to go and collect the food. So there were some losses at that point.
They'd arrived in the daylight.
Yes, early morning, and just in daylight. They should have been, if they'd started an hour before, they'd have been there and got the stuff and gone back again, you see. Unhappily, they just were not given the order at the right time, and they should never have come there. They should have stopped.
They gave the game away. Yes. While we're on the subject of food, and I think this is important, isn't it? I wonder if I could ask you about the sort of food you were getting, you know, the rations you had on Gallipoli.
Well, for the first few days or weeks, we were eating biscuits, army biscuits, something like a dog biscuit, and bully beef in cans, which in the heat, when you cut the can open, simply poured out fat and was most unpleasing to eat. We had tins of jam. All the jam that ever was that came there was always apricot, never anything other than apricot, until we were sick and tired of the thing. We used to use the unopened tins to make doorsteps into the trench and so on. And if you wanted to eat it, you know, the black flies there were in their millions. Life was nothing but flies all around you. And we were given fly nets to put over our heads, bags, really, a fly bag you put over your head and over your face. And into that you would put your biscuit and your jam, if you could get it in there quickly, and then close it up underneath, and then with a buzzing all around you so that you couldn't even see through it with the flies outside, you could then have a meal of biscuit and jam. And that's really the simplest way of eating. When we made ourselves a shallow dugout and put a roof of a blanket over the top, the blanket at night was solid with flies, and it was a great point that if anybody came to visit you, you had to say, "For heaven's sake, don't bang your head on the flies, otherwise you'll bring them all down." If you did touch it, the whole of the mass of black flies would come onto you then. There were unusual things happened there. At one period, I was near a large incinerator on the beach that had been built to dispose of rubbish, and everybody threw their rigid unopened tins of jam into the incinerator. Another hapless soldier marching nearby, there would be a loud explosion, he'd be covered with boiling jam, and we'd be taken away sick, as wounded by jam, by hot jam. Unusual form of danger. I don't know how they would mention that out among the list of wounding, beaten by hot jam, but it was true.
How about water? How did you fare for water supplies?
Water was a great problem. The few wells that we could find were so poisoned, or with bodies in them and so on, when we got to them, they were a danger to touch. And so the water was brought from Cairo, from Alexandria, in petrol cans. And we were issued with one billy can per day, which meant we had nothing to wash with or anything like that. It was truly there for making tea and drinking as it was. It was unpleasant water, much better made as tea. And we always reckoned to take an agreement that we would save one tin full amongst us for Sunday, when we would shave, the only day of the week, and then we would fetch out our razors. These were the days of old-fashioned razors, too many of them, and would have this precious water getting soapier and soapier, and a little group of us would then have our weekly shave. But that was the only water we could touch.
Did you get very thirsty in the heat?
Yes. Your tongue became rather like a piece of blackened leather. You could bang it up and down in your mouth. It was extraordinarily difficult. I tell a story which I don't think I sent you a copy of that, where I went for a walk along to visit the next door people, the Irish Rifles, and I saw to my interest that they were in the shade of a magnificent glossy-leafed tree or shrub. And I recognized this with the thought it had little star-like pink flowers. And so, to the surprise of the chaps in the trench below, I crawled across and got into the branches of this and came back again with four ripe pomegranates, which I had recognized through looking at the pictures of our family Bible, which showed the pomegranate. And remembering the little pink flowers and the fruit, I managed to get these. I gave one to the people there, I gave one to the company commander, and the other two we had amongst my own platoon. And every single juicy seed was nectar to us. Never had any more, but that was a remarkable find. We had figs, but they were still green, and you can't do anything with a green fig. It was like flannel. You could cut it up, but it was inedible. But there was blackberries, because when one of my friends was also in the church at home, and I, celebrating his birthday, we made a mixture of pounded biscuit and blackberries and a few bits of very, very flannelly pieces of figs. But that was all we could find growing locally or using. Except for one strange occasion. There was one morning when in the front line the mists rose to such a degree that you could hardly see more than a couple of yards. And just over the other side of our trench was what had been a sort of an allotment. And there were ripe melons. You could see them through the peephole if you looked at them. And in this thick mist, one by one, we got out of the front line trench and we went gathering melons. And all was peaceful, and we got a fine handful of melons each to take back, when suddenly they opened fire and we ran madly back quite safely into our trenches again. But in that time, we were able to get real fresh melons. Marvellous.
Yes, it would seem, you know, from what you've described, that there was quite a bit of vegetation about this area. Is that right? You know, that there were trees and...
It's rather interesting. The whole of that valley was... there was nothing in the way of a building anywhere, except possibly an odd shed built of stones with just branches across the top and that kind of thing. In other words, it was quite obvious nobody actually lived there. But there were little areas in which they had done cultivation. Well, as I say, we were able to get melons there. I suppose there were some others, though most of us were almost on the edge of the Salt Lake. But as you went up, you did find signs of growing of food of some kind. Nothing serious. I think it must have been too far away from the nearest town, because the nearest town must have been over the other side over here somewhere.
Yes.
I'm glad you got this. I've never...
Could I ask you now about the British trench system as you knew it? You know, the sort of layout of the trenches, the depth and the communication trenches.
Now, we're talking about Gallipoli.
Yes. Oh, yes, just Gallipoli.
Well, in Gallipoli, they were not dug with the care and forethought that they were in France. They were, in the main, simply wandering along up and down over the different low hills at the foot of cliffs, and the cliffs, of course, were more or less unsurmountable. There was a gap in the cliffs, but we were never able to get into it. But they were very poorly dug trenches. You see, fortunately, the ground was dry. There was big stones about, things like that. But you couldn't get any timber. You know, there nothing was. There was no civilization at all at Suvla when we got there, except for these little bits of garden and one or two rough stone sheds. There was no habitation, no sign of life at all. Quite evident they just came there to do some of them to do a bit of digging and then probably went back over the hills to the town below, wherever it might have been. We never saw any town. We never saw any sign of habitation of any kind when I was there.
So how about your communication trenches? Did you have such things, you know?
Yes, we're back, but they weren't. There was very thick scrub there everywhere, and so you didn't require necessarily to take your trenches back far, as long as you knew the way to get in. And that was where this problem came from mine. I had to, as a battalion scout, one time they saw my scout badge, I'd be given the job to lead new reinforcements up to the trenches. And nobody could find their way much otherwise. All amongst that, there were just these wandering tracks. All had their problems. One gave me a bit of a shock, and I remember to this day. That is, I'm going along this track, and there's a bush by the side, and under the bush is a body. And the poor fellow is pointing his hand up like that.
With his finger
dead.
Out.
Yes, been dead days. Possibly longer than that. Early, very early days I saw that. Gave me quite a shock to see this poor chap left like that and dried up almost with the heat. Heat was fantastic there at times in those early days.
Yes, what's your job, you know, as scout? Was it quite dangerous, you know? Did it mean that you were more exposed because you were hopping about more, leading...
I don't think it made much difference, really. I'd be told there's a new reinforcement arriving, 3 officers and 50 men, they don't know their way there. I might tell you, I used to get lost finding my way there too, all through this deep gullies and so on. An interesting point, though, and that was digging our way through one of these heavy gullies, we found Roman pavement, undamaged, where it had been at one time a Roman road. There were strange things could be found there. There were snakes, of course, apart from what I was telling you about the tortoise. When they had one period, or one part of the line, when you wanted to get up from the Salt Lake, you had to go along a track for safety's sake in a trench. And in the daytime, you went along this trench to get up into the bushes and away, and it always filled up with snakes, and they were poisonous snakes. And so you'd start off along the trench, and then you'd go back a bit and get a spade or something to go along and deal with that snake. So there were dangerous snakes. I never heard of anybody getting snake bite. I suppose they must have done. I know I found a beautiful viper about 1 foot long, golden coloured one. I would like to have made a pet of it almost. I think it was safe, that one. Probably safer with tortoises, anyway. Well, they were the only live things we did see there. We never saw any animal, anything big.
Going back to your scout job, you know, these groups that you led mm-hmm. to Suvla, presumably these would not have been freshly landed troops. They would have been troops from other areas, would they?
No, they'd be freshly landed.
Would they? Yes. Were you able to sort of put them wise about Gallipoli, what to expect?
Well, you try to on the way along and say, don't turn around or do this and so on to them. But you sort of handed them over and they got their learning from the... people they were taking over with, actually, in the trenches themselves. I don't think I ever looked upon myself as being an advisor of this little lot. I merely took these young officers and got them up there. They promptly found their way back to the hospital, many of them, because they were so green. They caught the diseases or they were ill very quickly. That's why our numbers went from over 1,000 down to 87 when I left.
Yes, I was going to ask you, you know, about health factors. You mentioned the flies. I was wondering also about lice. Did you get fleas?
Oh, yes. Not fleas, but lice, the same way they did in... We had what you might call the hot weather lice, you see, a different variety than they had in France. All I know is that we used to have a celebration, and on a weekend particularly, we'd go all the way around the edges of our shirts. But one thing we did do when we got down to the shore on a rest period was to put our shirts into the sea with a couple of stones on it, with the idea of killing the lice that way, you see. Bring it out and then dry it in the sun, and very often you've got nothing but eggs left after that.
Yes. Were they dangerous at all, the lice? You know, could you get disease from them?
Probably could, but we shouldn't know that. I got enteric fever, so I might have got it from lice for all I know. But the trouble was they would move about, and they always got just above your putty, you see. So it went round and round and round, trying to get down or trying to get up, so that you had a certain point on your body in which the lice were on the continuous move. The rest of them were resting in the seams and so on. Unpleasant thing. But quite tiny.
I was wondering, you were saying about your shave, your weekly shave, which seems so precious to you.
Yes, it was indeed.
I was wondering about other sanitary arrangements. You know, how about latrines? Did this pose any problem in the heat, you know, and bearing in mind how vulnerable you were to Turkish fire?
Well, the trouble really was that so many of them had dysentery, and dysentery, of course, had appalling diarrhoea too. And poor chaps you'd see almost dying, being unable to get back to one of these latrine cans that we'd put. What we dug a trench and just put a latrine can there. I'm afraid the sanitation was about nil, really.
Did that make life very unpleasant, you know, the fact that you didn't have facilities?
I don't think you worried about that. You know, it's all very normal when you're in a condition like that. You just wander away when you feel that you must, and came back in due course. You had to sleep in the trenches, you must bear in mind, with people walking on you or over you or around you. It was a life of complete discomfort, whether you were in Gallipoli or anywhere else, in trenches.
When you, you know, within your own experience, what proportion of men do you think suffered from disease compared with wounded? You know, would you think?
Well, it's very difficult to answer for the simple reason that you don't know why a man is sick, and he asks to go and see the doctor, and he sees the doctor, and the doctor says, "All right, we'll send you down to the hospital." Now, at that stage, although we'd been given injections, one caught these various things. They didn't know what was wrong with me. They only found that I was unconscious. And at night time, they'd find me unconscious in the trench and couldn't be wakened up for some time. So, and then when I went to see the doctor, he wasn't very helpful to begin with. But he seemed to be under the impression that I was a scrimshanker and I wanted to get away from the front sort of business. So I was rather cross. So I went back into the trenches and I did a little more falling asleep at intervals. And second time, they sent me down to the hospital, and the doctor said, "What are you doing with a condition like this? You've got a temperature of 105. I said, "Well," the doctor said, "there's nothing wrong with me." He said, "Well, he was all wrong." But apparently there was an attitude on the part of some of these frontline doctors to say, "Oh, I know, you're only trying to get out of it, you see." Because nobody wanted to stop in a trench, obviously.
Do you remember how you felt with this enteric fever? How it affected you, apart from going to sleep?
Well, I don't think I suffered much in the way of pain. I couldn't enjoy food, but the food wasn't particularly enjoyable anyway. We didn't know what it was. We put it down to rheumatic fever. That's the term they gave for it. I got obviously aches and things, you see. And as I say, they sent me to the hospital, and I was in the hospital there in the tent with its big Red Cross flag on it, by which the Turks never fire on it. And if ever the Turks flashed their heliograph up on the mountains, sending us a message, and it would say, "Your guns are being moved too near your hospital." And the order was, "Better move them away or else they'll open fire, which will hit the hospital as well." So, and up on the mountain there, in the complete area, you'd see a long white line like this with a big Turkish half moon on the flag at each end to show that was where the Turkish wounded were. and we in turn don't fire at that, of course. Seems rather extraordinary in a place like that where you couldn't even lift your head up in a trench, and yet we could have a place like that 10 times the size of this room and never being harmed by either side. So that we did quite honestly stick by the Red Cross.
Given the fact that there was such ill health on Gallipoli, do you think that undermined morale at all?
Certainly did. People were just were ill. We weren't in a fit condition to start a new battle. I never imagined that. All we could do was to hold the line.
I haven't asked you about the supply of munitions and equipment on Gallipoli. Were you able to get the ammunition you wanted?
There was never any trouble there, because you see, right from the very beginning there were so many casualties, and everybody had been given more bandoliers of ammunition than they would normally be carried, and so you'd go along with these things hanging around a terrific weight, but nevertheless you'd got them. And of course later on there were so many occasions where you could go and collect all these things, so I can't say there was ever any shortage of ammunition.
So when men died, were their bodies stripped, of the ammunition? Did that happen, that people went and sort of took their ammunition?
Well, they probably wouldn't be, if they died when marching there, yes, well, that might be a point, but if they're actually in the trenches, of course, they wouldn't be carrying bandoliers. They'd only have a little ammunition with them, because they'd be having it nearby, you see, or hanging it up in the trench somewhere. Added, which, of course, it was sort of always available. You just grab one of these rolls of ammunition and put it in your rifle.
Was there much interaction with the Navy once you were on Suvla, so far as you knew? Were you aware of the Navy?
Well, when we were actually marching across the Salt Lake into the battleground, the big naval ships were out at shore and were firing heavy cannon, heavy shells right up into the hills beyond us. I don't think we ever had any trouble like they did in France with shells falling amongst us. I think, generally speaking, when it was the Navy, they weren't firing anywhere near the trenches. They were firing right up into where they hoped to get the Turkish reinforcements.
Was it a comfort to you to have the Navy there?
Yes, we were very sad when it moved away, but when they had a big battleship there banging away, that was a great comfort. It didn't do us any good, but it certainly made an awful lot of noise, and you felt, well, that's another one for them. Our opinion was it was we were being supported, so that when you saw the naval ship being moved away, we thought it was a great pity.
I was also wondering, you were saying about on the Ulysses, how the captain wouldn't let you wear your boots. Mm. Did you mix at all with the sailors? I wonder if there was any sort of
Yes and no, because the funny thing was, in the evenings the sailors used to run housey parties. That's a lotto parties, and they'd hand out the cards and you'd give them the cash, whatever it was, 4 or 6 months, whatever it might be, and then we'd all sit in a great heap on the deck in the sunshine, or in the evening in the warmth too, it's all warm going through the Mediterranean, and in August as it was, and there this sailor would sit with his friend would go around doing the collecting, you see, and then he'd read out and the official clickety clicks and all the other stories that went with it, and you'd either use, I don't know what you'd use, bits of matchstick or anything else to lay on the cards, and at the end of the time somebody got a handful of silver, and the next night he lost it again, probably. That was about one of the few entertainments we had, and as far as I know, we never had much to do with the sailors at all. They got their own end of the ship. They didn't sort of wander amongst us, you see, except when on work. I think I was given another stripe because I was an NCO with physical training course I'd taken, and I was the only one that could be heard. I had a very powerful voice. I could keep these fellows doing arms bending and stretching and so on, all the way along one side of a big ship's gangway, and everybody could hear me, and I was the only person who could be heard. it stood me in very good stead most of my life. I'm sorry when my voice eventually gave up.
Yes, well, it's doing very well today, I think. Hold up on Gallipoli.
There was no trouble in any way like that. We had every respect and regard for our officers, but unhappily they didn't last long. Most of them went off sick, actually, and apart from those that had been wounded, of course. But we lost them mainly from sickness. A new group of people would come, and almost before they were in, they began to catch dysentery or something like that.